Association of Governments Public Safety Committee meeting. I will be chairing the meeting. My name is Mayor Pro Tem Wayman Furman from the City of Indio. And we will start with a roll call, please.
City of Blythe? City of Cathedral City?
Here.
City of Coachella? I do see her as an attendee. We will move her as a panelist. I'll come back. City of Desert Hot Springs? City of Indian Wells? City of Indio?
Present.
City of La Quinta?
Present.
City of Palm Desert?
Present.
City of Palm Springs? City of Rancho Mirage?
Here.
County of Riverside?
Present.
And City of Coachella?
Present.
Looks like she's on. Okay, so before we get started, I just want to add that pursuant to Governor Newsom's executive orders, we are able to hold this committee meeting remotely. So we'll move forward with the Pledge of Allegiance, and Councilmember Pena will lead us in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please join me. Stand and put your hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America, and to the
Republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Mr. Pena. Next item on the agenda is public comments for agenda items, and I believe we do not have any public comments. So I will move forward to chair, committee members, and CVAC staff comments. I'll go ahead and start it, and I just wanted to tell everyone Happy New Year. It's been a while since we've seen everyone. There's been a lot going on. So I'm looking forward to some of the presentations this meeting. There's going to be some informative information as far as COVID and the vaccine. And do we have any committee members who would like to add to the comments? Nothing,
Chair.
Megan, we don't have nothing, Megan?
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. Chair, if I may, I do have a couple of comments. The first is that I want to welcome our new captain, Hernan Lopez. I'm not sure if he's attending the meeting today, but we do have a new captain in Coachella. Our former captain, Misty Reynolds, has moved on, I believe, to the homicide department. So we're excited to work with Captain Lopez. And related to that, I guess, is that we have started holding more internal meetings of our public safety committee in collaboration with the sheriff's department. And that has, I think, really opened the dialogue and clarified some areas of doubt on both sides. And it's helping us to move in a clearer direction toward what will be our next phase of public safety in Coachella. So just wanted to share that. It's very exciting progress. And we're continuing to work hard. Thank you.
Great. Great. Do we have any other comments? Well, before we move forward, I'd like to welcome some of our new members to the Public Safety Committee. We have Councilmember Roger Nunez from Desert Hot Springs. We also have Councilmember Greg Sanders from Indian Wells. And we have Karina Campania from Palm Desert. Welcome to the Public Safety Committee meeting. Would you all like to have a couple of words?
Sure, if the others are present, I will go ahead, and it's my great privilege and pleasure to be here and be the new member of the committee and be an advocate for people's voices. It's been a great experience to be able to serve as the first time elected official and be able to serve on a regional level and collaborate and learn what our sister cities are doing and finding how to benefit from a regional approach and where we overlap. So I'm here to learn, and I'm again elated, and thank you very much.
Great, Karina, welcome.
Hi, this is Greg Sanders. Very excited to join and looking forward to a great year. Thank you.
Great, welcome, Greg. Is Roger on? I'm not sure if Roger's on. Is he in the waiting room?
We don't see him yet, but we will keep an eye out.
Okay, well, if he joins us, we'll get him up. We'll move on to the next item, which is ex officio updates. I see we have 27 participants. And so it's been a long time since we met last time, there's been a lot going on in our community. So if our ex officio members would raise their hand and we'll go ahead and move forward with comments from our ex officio members. We got some hands in there.
We do have a couple of hands. Chief Reyes, I believe, was first, followed by Chief Washburn. And if you are on the phone, if you use star 9, you can also use the raise hand feature.
So we'll go with Chief Reyes from Palm Springs.
Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to be very brief by congratulating Jeff and Wagner on his selection as CEO for Riverside County. In talking with the chiefs of police throughout the county, we were extremely pleased with his selection, extremely qualified, and looking forward to working with you. Congratulations.
Thanks, Chief.
Absolutely. Do we have Chief Washburn up?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, congratulations, Jeff. As far as Indio's going, our COVID numbers, we have more exposures, but really not too many serious illnesses. We have one of our employees is in the hospital, has been for about 4 days. Advanced to other issues as opposed to COVID related. But COVID's what got her sick in the first place. So other than that, we're doing very well with the COVID stuff. We continue to hire, there is kind of a general, morale issue across law enforcement in the entire nation, to include Indio. And a part of it, is part of this. We literally asked during our screening, during the hiring, how do you blow off stress? And it's going to the gym, hanging out with friends, et cetera, the social aspects. No one can do any of that stuff. So might be a little bit of transference and blaming, it's the issues with the department, it's the anti-police rhetoric that people have heard. But at the end of the day, we can't deny the effects of COVID. That's well documented in all arenas of life. So with that, I'm all done.
Thanks, Chief Washburn. Do we have any other hands raised, Erica?
I don't see any, but for the record, Mayor Holstage from the City of Palm Springs is here.
Hello, Mayor Holstage and the little one.
Hi.
Good morning. So being that we have no more hands raised, we'll move on to our consent calendar. Is there any items anyone wishes to pull on the consent calendar? No. Okay, well, do I get a motion for approval?
Mr. Chair, also move, Laquinta.
Do we get a second?
Okay.
I'll second that from Rancho Mirage.
So got a motion from Councilmember Pena and a second from Iris Mock from Indian Wells. Do we have any
Rancho Mirage.
Oh, Rancho Mirage, I'm sorry. Any
it's
objections?
Okay. I like Indian Wells.
That'll work. Any objections or abstentions? Consent calendar passes. Okay. So we'll move on to the next item, which would be a discussion item, and it's an update on COVID-19 public health crisis from Mr. Jeff M. Wajanin from Riverside County.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Next slide, please. And then one more slide. Thank you. As everyone on this call knows, you've heard me give the updates basically every meeting almost for the last year. Riverside County is focused on the twin crises, both the public health emergency and the economic crisis. I'll try and address both of those briefly today. Next slide, please. Starting with the response, here are is the case information as of Friday, February 5th. Total number of confirmed cases countywide is over 280,000. Total number of deaths, 2,320. And recovered is 228,586. And as we know, recovered is a relative term. Some folks are still dealing with what's been labeled as the long haul effects. Hospitalization numbers, we have 847 COVID positive patients in our hospital and in our ICU, 220 COVID positive patients. Some good news systemically, across the system, we are now at 72% capacity, which is a significant improvement. Our ICUs are still over 100% capacity across the system at 113% capacity. But I will tell you, these numbers are significantly down over the last several weeks. And while this is a positive trend and we are optimistic, there are still many sick people in the hospital. And we know that as we're dealing through it. The rates as of February 7th, as of yesterday, the actual case rate per 100,000 is 46.5, and our adjusted case rate is 46.5 per 100,000. We are currently testing 479.1 people per 100,000, which is a significant number, but that number's been dropping as more folks have been getting vaccinated. Fortunately, the state average has also been dropping, but that is something that we need to keep an eye on since our testing and case rate are tied into the opening metrics. Our overall positivity rate, 14.6%, and the health equity positivity rate is 16.3. As a reminder, that's the bottom quartile. And our state metric is currently in the purple tier. Again, those numbers, those case rate numbers are significantly better than they were a month ago, but again, too high. Next slide, please. And I know what folks have certainly been focusing on is the vaccination. Total doses received in the county to date, 241,750. Our providers have received more than 144,000 of those, and public health has received 97,000 of those. We have administered, of the 241, 226,656 doses. That is 91.3% of the doses received have gone into arms. We have done some research locally, and it appears to be the highest in Southern California, possibly in the state. In terms of eligibility as to who is getting the vaccine is phase 1A, which was rough, you know, generally speaking, the healthcare workers. Phase 1B, tier one, where we added school teachers and the emergency responders and first responders. On Sunday, we lowered the age available to 70 or older. We anticipate dropping that number to 65 later today or tomorrow. And accounting appointments to our sites can be made online or by calling 211, or there's a direct dial number. The government-run vaccination sites, there are 8 what we call pods, points of distribution, run by the County Public Health. We have 1 mobile team, and we are standing up another mobile team shortly. There is a state site, and there is 1 city site that is running it in partnership with a vendor, and that's on the west side of the county. As it relates to our partner providers, the hospitals, the clinics, the pharmacies, are all engaged in distributing the vaccination. Additionally, a special program was set up through public health for our first responders and emergency response personnel. That includes the sheriff's department, all of the police departments, as well as the fire departments. The good news is that the system that we have set up, we are able to scale up quickly. We can replicate our pod system across the county. The limiting factor remains the number of doses. We, as you can see, we are putting, you know, more than 90% of doses into arms within 2 to 4 days of when we get them. We just need to get more doses, and that's going to be one of the focuses of our efforts moving forward. There's been a lot of questions about second dose procedures. As it relates to county sites, we have set up special second dose clinics, and that is specifically for those individuals who have received their first dose, so we can get the second one in the arm. Eligible individuals who received the dose from the county will receive notification. We're doing that via whatever preference the individuals select at the time of the first dose. That's email, text, or some other preferred medium. Those individuals who receive their first dose from a provider will need to schedule directly with those folks. On the horizon, we have learned that FEMA and Cal OES, the Office of Emergency Services, are partnering to stand up some mega sites. So far, they have scheduled 4 mega sites across the state. None of those are currently in Riverside County. Next slide, please. On the business side, Supervisor Perez and the Board of Supervisors have focused on the devastating economic impacts almost from the very beginning of the crisis. Through their leadership, tens of millions of dollars have been put back into the community. This slide specifically shows some of the projects that have helped thousands of individuals, families, and business over the course of the last several months. We know it's not enough, and we also know that the CARES Act funding that supports these efforts have mostly been spent. We are watching the new legislation that was passed in December, the new legislation that is still working its way through Congress now, and calculating what those impacts will be locally so that we can make sure and continue the effort. We learned that we are getting more than $50 million from the federal government for rental assistance and support that will also go to paying utilities for those who have fallen behind. But that is coming out in the next week or so. With that, that is the end of the report, and I am certainly available for any questions if you want to go to the next slide.
Great, thanks, Jeff. Do we have any questions for Jeff?
I do have a question because I've been getting a lot of questions because there's so much going on the internet as far as information about COVID and different results and different illnesses. And some of it may be true, some of it may be misleading, but a number of people have asked about people who may have been brought into a hospital because of a stroke or a heart attack or an accident, but they may also test positive for COVID. Is there any way of defining which patients go where and how this affects the statistics?
Yes, well, in terms of if somebody has COVID and in our hospitals, they are counted as a COVID hospitalization because we have to treat that individual as being COVID positive.
Obviously, if they were brought in because of a heart attack or a stroke or a car accident.
Yes, because they're still, in terms of the hospitalization, we still have to treat them as a COVID patient for our internal protocols. So certainly that those individuals will be treated, obviously, for the stroke or the heart attack or the car accident. But from the healthcare perspective, although some of the treatment may change, in terms of the protocols to keep staff safe and other patients safe, we have to count them or treat them as COVID positive.
So they would be part of this, the statistical numbers?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Good question. Do we have any more questions for Mr. Van Wagenen?
Yes, I have a question. In terms of the second appointments, will those be reached out in terms of the order in which the first appointment was received? Will this be by tier in terms of industry or age, or how will that be conducted? There's a lot of questions on that.
My understanding is that it will be in time. The first people who receive the first dose will be reached, will contact them first, because I know that there's a lot of concern from individuals that they're going to be bumping up against the timelines. So we are reaching out in, my understanding is, in the order that we gave the first dose.
Thank you very much. That helps a lot.
Great. And Jeff, I just want to confirm, we have sites already set up for the second dose, or is it, how's that going to work out?
Yes, we do.
Great.
And just for what it's worth, one of the things we found, just as an aside, and if you want in your messaging to help echo this, we've been sending information for links for appointments for those second dose clinics, and people have been sharing that information with their friends and loved ones so that it's specific to the individual for a second dose. But then we identify, because it's a, in essence, it's a path to that dose, that individuals have been sharing that so that people could get kind of their own streamline for their first dose. So some of the messaging you'll see from us is that it is, the link is specific to the individual and only for those individuals who have already had their first dose.
Okay, one additional question. For the people who may not have a computer system and may not have an email address, how are they being notified that they are certainly okay to come in for their second dose?
Again, when they got their first dose, we're taking a preference on how they want to be contacted so that we are doing some text messaging as well.
Okay.
Great. We have a question from Councilmember Jacinto.
Thanks, Jeff, for that update. And I was wondering about the private providers. Are they also required to follow the state's phasing tiers?
Yes. They are certainly supposed to, and that's the expectation.
Okay. And then as far as people seeking appointments, in addition to trying to get appointments through the Riverside County website or the sites provided by the county, then they could be privately, they could be contacting the private providers as well if they're in the appropriate tier?
They can.
Okay. The other question I had is, you know, we're hearing a lot about people that are declining or refusing to take the vaccines, even when their tiers are up. I wondered if the county has a metric on that. Has it been keeping track of how prevalent that is?
We have been doing our own internal surveys of our departments. For example, early on, you might have seen some information about healthcare workers. We also, just like I imagine all of the police departments and fire departments on this phone call, have been doing their own internal surveys to determine how many folks are interested in it. What we found is sort of what we've seen across the country early on. I would say it was roughly 45 to 50% of the people were interested in receiving the vaccine. I will tell you that as time has gone on, we've seen those numbers creep up. That as folks get more comfortable with, you know, what impacts or effects the dose might have on them, and that it is safe, we're seeing more people being willing to take the vaccine. I mean, I know we had some conversations, and maybe some of you on this have had some experience. Some folks are tired. Some have, you know, soreness in the arm. Some have some sort of inflammation. But as people realize that it is a is safe and there's not, you know, significant impacts, we're seeing more people willing to take it. And I imagine that if you were to ask the folks on the, you know, the ex officio members, they would be seeing something similar in their own departments.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, one additional question. The new Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine, is that available yet?
No.
My
understanding is that that's still working its way through the emergency authorization process.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
Well, I have like a follow-up question, if I may.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Is there any, my understanding is that at this time there has not been any effort to track the demographics of individuals that have been vaccinated. Is that something that may come about for subsequent vaccination drives or in registering individuals just to see how Riverside County is faring in terms of what demographics and populations to reach out for increased outreach for to make sure we have equitable vaccination across the board?
We are engaging in that effort now. Similarly, like you saw the positivity rate when I reported about the health equity positivity rate, we are also looking at the dosages to make sure that our lowest quartile is not left behind. As we know, many individuals in that category are some of our most essential workers. Some of them have some of our have challenges with health coverage. So we, as we continue to evolve, and that's really what we're doing the mobile clinics with, we're going to target those demographics to make sure that no one is left behind. We've done two farm worker clinics specifically for farm workers. We went out to Blythe last week. We're going to be continuing to target to make sure that that everyone comes along.
Great. Mayor Hostich.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question if I can, similar to that, but is the county going to set aside appointments for essential workers? I know we talked about on the Supervisor Prez's call that cooks and restaurant workers and other food workers have a higher mortality rate along with farm workers. And my question is, can the county put aside, you know, appointment slots or different clinics just for those workers?
Mayor Holsich, thank you for that question. And you referenced the meeting that Supervisor Perez had on Friday with Coachella Valley leadership. That is something that we're looking at doing. Similar to how we did with first responders and healthcare workers, we're looking to see if there's something we can do in that area.
Thank you. I know that would be much appreciated for all from all our workers.
Great question.
Okay, can I just go back to my original question in regard to people being brought in because of other health problems? If somebody who has had a heart attack or a stroke or an accident, if they die and they still have COVID after being tested, how is their cause of death being listed?
It's being listed I'm sorry.
Is that good? Are they going to fall into the COVID statistics, or are they going to be listed as dying from other problems?
The way that we've been doing it from the beginning is really, what is the cause of death, or what's the contributing cause of death? If somebody dies from what amounts to a car accident, injuries sustained in a car accident, and COVID was just along for the ride, for lack of a better term, then it would be the car accident. It would be the blunt force trauma. So it's whatever is the cause of death. Now, there are some situations where COVID was certainly a major contributing factor, and that would be calculated as a COVID death. For example, someone suffering from some sort of lung disease where COVID may have complicated that and accelerated the disease would be a COVID death. So what we're doing is it's the hospital, it's the coroner's office that are working to make sure that we can accurately report that data. And that's been from the beginning for us, at least.
Okay, good. Because I've had a lot of questions about that is that skewing the numbers? So, and how they were going to be counted. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, it looks like that's, Mayor Hostess, you got one?
I have one more question if I can. Okay. Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. We have our CVAG homelessness meeting next week. So I know we're getting an update from the county, but just as it relates to public safety, you talked a little bit about rental assistance. I know that the Biden administration, it sounds like, also changed the FEMA reimbursement rate to 100%, especially for homelessness and housing. So I'm wondering, you know, in Palm Springs is hosting a lot of the Project Room Key and Home Key folks, and our numbers have increased, and we're getting a lot of comments from our residents that we're seeing a lot more homeless people. And obviously it's a crisis and a pandemic. So I'm wondering if the county is looking at continuing or expanding those programs using the FEMA reimbursement at 100%.
You know, ultimately I would refer you to that homeless committee meeting for the best and latest information. But my understanding is, yes, we are looking at using additional resources to continue those programs. In addition to the straight rental assistance, as I mentioned, I think we're getting $57 million net new dollars to go towards this effort. So homelessness, as we know in this committee, at least as long as I've been on it, is a public safety concern, an issue that we're trying to work through. And in some ways, it's sort of been pushed a little bit to the back of the mind for some folks because of the pandemic. But we know the problem has not gone away. And if anything, it's only going to get worse potentially in the coming months. So that is one of the priorities, certainly, of our Board of Supervisors.
Chair, if I might piggyback, and we will certainly be discussing this at the Homelessness Committee meeting, but the continuation of Project Room Key in particular is a way that CVAG's own regional program can help coordinate with the county and make sure that folks are getting connected to the services as well. But we will have a more detailed briefing.
Thank you, Erica. And then one more thing to add is we're also looking to use some of the money to buy some old or dilapidated or closed motels so that we can provide more long-term stable housing for individuals.
Great. Thank you. Great. We have some hotels for you.
Thanks, Jeff, for the update. Great questions, especially regarding the homeless. I'm looking forward to the homelessness committee meeting because we do have folks out there who need PPE and need to follow the guidelines and who are really at risk, all ages and backgrounds. So that's good information. Thank you, Jeff. Next item, and that's a discussion item, and the next item is also a discussion item, and that's continued conversation on race, diversity, and policing, and Erica will be handling this.
Thank you, Chair. Before I start, I did want to just announce for the record that Councilmember Nunez from Desert Hot Springs is here as well. So welcome, and welcome to the committee. 8B, for those of you who've been on the committee, know that this has been an item that has been discussed quite at length since about June last year, first under then Chair Pena and now under Chair Furman. We did have an ad hoc committee that has met as well. And in December, the executive committee passed a resolution that pledged our commitment to continue to listen and be engaged. In summary, the county has put together some information to their listening sessions, which have been quite extensive. And we have Jeff back to kind of go through some of the data that they have pulled together and some of the highlights from their listening sessions. So I will turn it over to Jeff there.
Thank you, Erica. And I apologize to everybody that you're getting a double dose of me, but I guess it's in line with our vaccination, two dose of a Van Wagenen today. Next slide, please. And then one more. My briefing today is going to focus really on four areas. It's going to be the background, in essence, how we got here. The second item will be the feedback from our board listening sessions. The third will be a recap of a board workshop that we conducted following those listening sessions. And then finally, a description of next steps. Next slide, please. What I wanted to share this slide for in the dates is that our board has been engaged on this effort since the summer. It started on July 24th with a commitment to evidence-based policing and transparency. Many of the individuals on this call are well aware of action taken by our cops, by the Sheriff's Department, by the DA's office to create a force investigation detail and the rollout of our CBAT teams, which is additional mental health professionals riding alongside law enforcement, in essence on patrol, so they can respond to calls. A little bit more on that later. And we anticipate bringing the funding for that effort back to the Board of Supervisors at our next meeting on March 2nd. But then it continued with, you know, reevaluating how we deliver services and what our priorities are amid the social change. On August 4th, the board declared racism and inequity a public health crisis. We held three listening sessions in September and October. And then the summary of that, the listening sessions were in November and the board workshop was in December. And each of these has been a series of progressions building on the ones that came before it. Next slide, please. The slide's a little bit small, so I will kind of hit the broad view is we partnered with the UC Riverside School of Public Policy to listen to the listening sessions and to do some analysis of what it was that we heard. We had 111 speakers make 150 comments over 3 days. We were able to group the comments into seven broad themes. This chart breaks out which of those or how many folks or what percentage of the comments fell into each of those pieces of the pie. In this order, in terms of the number of comments, first was systemic racism and inequity. Second was funding for social services. Three was public safety and criminal justice reform. Obviously, those three are all related to each other. We also heard about the COVID-19 impacts, education, climate change, and marijuana and industrial hemp. Next slide, please. As part of what UCR did, they also gave us some recommendations. First, they wanted to acknowledge that the representativeness of the public listening session was relatively limited. We certainly heard from 111 people and we were glad that those folks came forward and made comments, but we recognized that the sample was not necessarily representative of our population. The recommendation from, and next bullet please, the recommendation was for a more structured feedback. One that is online, especially in today's world, webinar style, that mimics more of a traditional town hall. The idea was potentially the recommendation to conduct two or three virtual town halls in early 2021 to obtain a more structured feedback. Next bullet, please. The other recommendation was to review best practices from across other California counties. And I would extend that to cities. As we know, we're not in this alone. We're all in this together. And we are certainly not above taking what others have done and either copying them if they're working well or improving upon them where we can. Next bullet. And then to come forward with a set of policy prescriptions that the Board of Supervisors could continue. Next slide, please. So the board then did a workshop for county departments to present to the board in light of what it was that we heard during the listening sessions. One of the things that we launched was an unincorporated communities initiative. The goal was to assess the needs by community. As we know, not all of our unincorporated communities are the same as each other. The needs in one could be vastly different from the other. Also to analyze our funding options, things that we could, you know, the different funding sources that we could use to pay for these efforts. It could be county general fund dollars, it could be DIF. We could create infrastructure districts, repurpose existing grant funding, find partners, et cetera. We wanted to cast a broad net about potential funding ways to meet these the needs of the community. And just one word on the needs. This is both services and infrastructure. Some communities wanted, you know, a different type of law enforcement or more law enforcement. Some needed, and again, this is back to inequity, some needed greater IT infrastructure, broadband support. Again, that's what we're going and engaging in, assessing the needs of the community. Number three was taking the needs. I'm sorry, back, you can keep that bullet, or we're still on the first one. To either align, or so the third button was to align the needs and the funding. And then finally, to apply methodology for prioritization of projects. We recognize that we will have more needs than dollars and that we have to start working our way off the list. So we're developing a methodology to do that. We have initiated all of this. It kicked it off in December, and we've already begun assessing needs by community by having a series of either attending MAC meetings, municipal advisory committee meetings, community meetings, virtually, so that we can hear directly from our residents. The next part of the workshop was presentations from departments. We asked for a representative sample of our departments so that we could hear directly from them and focused on these three questions. What were they doing now in these areas? What are they planning in the coming future? And what could they do with additional resources? We heard from behavioral health, DPSS, probation, sheriff's department, and housing and homeless prevention and workforce solutions. Next slide, please. Behavioral health, and you may have heard Dr. Chang, our director of behavioral health, talk about these before. The focus of behavioral health is the right place, right time, and right level of service to meet the needs of our residents. The increased use of our CBAT teams and mobile crisis response teams. This is something that the Coachella Valley was a leader on early on. Chief Reyes in Palm Springs adopted a CBAT personnel into their structure. What that is it's a behavioral health personnel who rides with a sworn law enforcement officer in the city of Palm Springs and is dispatched to those calls that appear to be mental health in nature, so that we can ultimately take the response, and so that it's not always specifically a law enforcement response, but we have now also the mental health response. Our goal is to add 9 more of these teams across the county. The other behavioral health, again, these are highlights from the presentations, was the development of a diversion campus. As we recognize that not every person arrested for a crime necessarily needs to go to jail, particularly when that individual has mental health challenges. So we are working on the development of a diversion campus where law enforcement personnel could take the individual to that campus. We're also partnering with the California Department of State Hospitals to develop a pilot program in Riverside County for those individuals who are incompetent to stand trial or at risk of becoming incompetent to stand trial so that they can be treated in the community. Next slide, please. The Department of Public Social Services presented, and they are working to expand their prevention programs and access to services. They are also increasing the use of multidisciplinary teams, interagency partnerships, and community outreach. And there are also plans for co-location of services. As the individuals on this meeting certainly know, that many times individuals who are receiving one type of service from the county or the city are often receiving other types of services. And the more that we can co-locate these services and become constituent or resident focused, the better. Next slide, please, or next button. Probation. Probation is, again, continuing to grow their effort on client-centered focus. Additionally, they are working harder to partner and fund community-based organizations, nonprofits, and faith-based groups. Chief Miller, who has participated in this meeting in the past, has talked about maybe it's not always on the probation side of the house necessary for someone with a badge and a gun to be engaged in the rehabilitative effort. Sometimes the folks who are with lived experience or from the community in a structured organization can be a better tool for us to use. And then finally, probation is leading our public safety discussion around systemic inequity. Right now, probation's been identifying and developing data that will help inform our decisions as we continue through this process. Next bullet. And the Sheriff's Department presented, in addition to being a partner on the CBAT team, the Sheriff's Department has increased the use of community service officers in the telephone reporting unit and took the lead along with our district attorney's office in creation of the force investigation detail in partnership with RCOPS. For those who are not familiar with that specifically, what it is the notion that generally speaking, we want to make sure that if there is a use of force or an officer or deputy involved shooting, that an agency investigates that that is not the agency where the officer works. So this is a multi-agency team that works to engage in this effort, again, to be more transparent and develop trust with the community. Next slide, please. And then we've identified what some of our next steps will be. We are scheduling a budget workshop. Our first workshop actually is tomorrow during the board meeting. One of the things that, and you may hear me say this more often than not, there's a quote I like. It goes something like this: don't tell me what your priorities are. Show me how you spend your money and I'll tell you what your priorities are. So one of the things that our board wants to focus on is to make sure that our spending and our priorities are aligned. So we're engaging in the workshop. This next bullet goes to that as well. Chair Spiegel is keen on holding a strategic planning workshop. So we'll be doing that before the budget is adopted, and that will inform our decisions moving forward. Additionally, down the road, we'll have a financial planning workshop that again, makes sure that spending is aligned with our strategic plans, including in this area. Next bullet, please. And then the board had considered the creation of an oversight advisory committee or a task force in this space. As of now, a decision has not yet been finalized on that issue. Next one. And then ultimately, to continue the momentum and report progress, this is a callback to the earlier slide where we talked about all the progressions that the board has made in this space. And so we will continue to the momentum and report progress in each of these areas, evaluating different frameworks and partnerships and methods of service delivery, seek increased diversity across our county government workforce. We obviously are a large employer. We employ 22,000 employees. We'll make sure that we are leading in the area of diversity. Also reviewing our policies, procedures, and practices, prioritizing investment in our disadvantaged communities, identifying and implementing solutions to eliminate systemic inequity, and also advocate for federal and state legislation. Next slide, please. And that is the end of the report on this topic, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions for Jeff?
I have a question. You talked about a ride-along person in regard to mental health issues. Where will there be a ride-along person also for domestic issues where someone is called out to a home where there's a problem domestically? Is that going to include a ride-along person to settle down an issue or to work with the couple or the family?
At this stage, and that's a better question for the chiefs who may be on the call, but I will tell you at this point, not specifically. Obviously, domestic violence situations are among the most dangerous that our law enforcement professionals respond to, certainly for their own safety and for the safety of those involved. And they receive a lot of training. In fact, you have one of the world experts on the subject of domestic violence on this call, Assistant District Attorney Jerry Fineman. But at this point, no, not specifically are we having, is there a plan to have domestic violence experts do the ride along, at least not at this stage.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'll expand on that. I've had an incident myself here in India where I came across somebody who I thought was having a mental illness episode. And when I called it in, I let them know we might want to dispatch our quality of life team and a behavioral health specialist out. And they came out, I watched her work, and it was great how it worked out. So these things do work. And thank you for this presentation, Jeff. This is a good double dose, and just to think that this thing is always going to evolve. We're in the people business, and things change, policies change, but what it boils down to is communication. I think an open line of communication with our community and our law enforcement community, and not just when we have incidents that are called into questions, but all the time. I think it should be a year-round conversation so we can all have that that rapport. And Chief Washburn touched on some things earlier that I want to comment on. It's also good to know what the other side is dealing with and their perspective, because you don't know what the other one's perspective is. If you're a law enforcement officer, unless you are a law enforcement officer, you don't know what it is like to put that badge on. Vice versa, if you are a part of a group that you feel that you're being marginalized, you may not understand that as well. So having these open lines of communication, these discussions are great, and I'm looking forward to being involved in them later on. So with that being said, do you have any other questions for Mr. Van Wagenen?
Yes, I have a question. In regards to the methodology, you said that the MACs, the Municipal Advisory Committees, would be setting the process for alignment. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on the number of those committees and who comprises these committees so that we can discuss the equity of how the methodology will be applied.
So if I said that, I apologize, it was my error. The county will be assessing the methodology and developing the methodology. The MACs are the groups that we go to and listen. So the MACs are the individuals or the groups that in other community groups that are sharing their needs, both as a group or as individuals attending those meetings. In terms of the methodology, that will be established by the county. And in terms of, you know, equity, what we're trying to do is to use some of the similar modeling that we do for our community development block grant programs so that we can identify, again, those are very similar to that. We have certainly more need than we have funds. And so that's kind of the process, but it won't be the MACs developing it. It'll be the county to develop that. And then one more thing, just Chair Furman, Chief Washburn has been a fantastic partner in the development and use of CBATs. And is really the success that we've seen in Indio is one of the reasons why we believe that we're gonna have great success across the county. And by adding additional teams, one of the benefits will be that if one is available in one area, there may be the ability to share that resource a little bit. I'm sorry.
I still had one more question after the methodology. My question is, you mentioned the recommendations were to schedule, and one of them was consider. That's an intangible action item. What will it take to move from consider to enact?
Well, it'll be somebody in my seat working with the board to determine what the appropriate level of oversight for this is, whether it is a board ad hoc committee, whether it is a task force, whether it's some other type of committee. One of the things that I talked to the board about is making sure that when we identify these strategic priorities, that we make sure that we set goals and measure our progress towards them. So ultimately it will be, you know, again, this office that I sit in now that will be driving to determine which direction the board wants to go.
Great, thank you. Any more questions for Jeff?
I do have a couple of questions. Jeff, thanks for your second great presentation of the day. I had a question about the unincorporated communities initiative, which will be assessing the needs by community. Is that also going to be implemented in the other jurisdictions like La Quinta and Coachella that utilize sheriff services?
Well, the unincorporated community initiative itself is, as the title implies, specifically for the unincorporated community. So Thermal, Mecca, areas like there. Now, in terms of the other cities, I know that the Sheriff's Department works for the city and will engage, you know, we have good partners at the Sheriff's Department and they'll engage the city. I think you mentioned some of the good meetings that you've been having in Coachella. So I think it's at a city level will be certainly, you know, that discussion with the Sheriff's Department and city leaders. I will tell you one of my commitments to the cities has been to make sure that we strengthen the partnership between our cities and the county, that we identify ways where the county can be a better partner and support the cities, and that we have regular engagement. During COVID early on, I was fortunate enough to be able to sit sort of in the liaison chair and work closely with all of your city managers and communicating, identifying ways that we can partner. And that is one of my goals moving forward, not just on this issue, but every issue.
That's great. And sort of following up to that and also thinking about the previous conversations we've had in this committee, you know, the subcommittee on this topic made a recommendation to conduct listening sessions across the valley, very similar to what the county has done. And I think this is great progress for the county. I'm glad that the limitations of the initial listening sessions have been recognized and there'll be some follow-up to add to them. And also, you know, similar to Councilmember Quintanilla, I hope that there will be steps taken toward enacting some of the things that are being considered just now, but thinking about how this filters down or how this relates to the communities here in the Valley, I think we still do need, particularly in light of what you just said, Jeff, I think we still do need those types of listening sessions. And I know Palm Springs did them as well, but for the rest of the communities to really drill down on what our individual communities are experiencing and expressing as needs, and also relate that to what law enforcement is telling us as far as the type of responsibilities they have that could be better handled by CBATs or other types of professionals better equipped to handle those situations than law enforcement. And I think, you know, appreciating what the county is doing, we need to still be doing that on a more local level, a more personalized level for the Valley and for the cities to ensure that we're implementing those policies in our jurisdictions as well, that will respond to the needs of our communities. And so I hope that the committee can, now that we have this report back from the county, I hope that we can take up again the question of conducting these regional policing listening sessions or conversations with the community.
Great. I think that's a great insight, Councilmember Jacinto. And I'm looking forward to it as well. I think we all need to do that. And moving forward, I think we'll all be looking forward to that as well. I know some of the other cities have done some of the listening sessions and worked with some of their police chiefs. And so I think if we follow that and create a mechanism for our communities to communicate directly with our chiefs and our public safety community, I think that'd be great as well. So with no other further questions, I'd like to move forward to the next item, which is a legislative update, and Erica be handling that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I see Jerry Feynman, I believe, on the screen as well. In the interest of time, I will just turn it over to him and just extend our thanks to the county for trifecta of presentations today. So thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gerald Feynman. I'm the Assistant District Attorney here in the Eastern Region. And Erica, if you want to go ahead and start the slideshow. There we go. So what I'm going to give this morning is a brief legal update on some of the changes that may impact us here in the Coachella Valley. This is an abbreviated version of a presentation I've given to law enforcement as well as our family justice centers. As you know, we have here in the Coachella Valley a family justice center, which is a multi-agency building where victims of family violence can come and receive resources. Next slide, please. The legislative session this past year was extremely different in that the legislature didn't meet for most of the session. And then at the very end of the session, they got back together and pushed a number of bills through. The result of this is that a lot of the bills that went through the process didn't have the same sort of vetting that normal pieces of legislation have, where the legislature can look at the language which is used, can consider some of the unintended consequences. And so as I give this presentation, even more than any other year where we passed legislation, there are a lot of things that are still to be determined about some of the pieces of legislation, especially in this criminal justice arena. Next slide, please. So one of the biggest changes was the Racial Justice Act. This was a piece of legislation which was introduced early in the session and appeared to have stalled. And then, like many of the pieces of legislation we'll discuss this morning, after the death of George Floyd, a number of bills were pressed through the legislature. And this was probably one of the largest sweeping bills. Next, please. It prohibits convictions based on race, ethnicity, or national origin. And certainly no one wants that. But what it does is it not only applies to the actions of a prosecutor. Next, please. But it applies to any action by a judge, any attorney, law enforcement, expert witness, or even a juror who exhibits bias or uses discriminatory language. Now, certainly in the initial conviction phase, this is something that would be perhaps more readily apparent, but what it creates is a lack of finality in criminal judgments. So you get through a criminal case and we may not know once we achieve a conviction whether that conviction will be permanent or not, because we may find that in the past or in the future, one of these participants uses or exhibits some type of bias or discriminatory language. Next, please. So what it does is creates a new penal code section. And this penal code section says that you can't charge or convict a defendant because of race, ethnicity, where the evidence establishes that the prosecution sought this or sought to punish this more severely because of race, ethnicity, or origin. Next, please. It applies also to sentences now. So now we're going to be looking at comparative sentences between offenders. And I can tell you, because even without regard to race or ethnicity or origin, we're constantly challenging prosecutors on how we be fair in each case, and yet how we take into consideration the difference of each type of participant. So that will create some more challenges for us, as well as for our partners on the defense bar. Next, please. And what it does is it allows for what's called a habeas proceeding, which means after the appellate remedies of a defendant are exhausted, that the defense can seek to go back on a case and have that conviction looked at again, reversed again. So this will create a whole new reign of litigation, which will burden both the prosecution and our public defender's office. So we're going to see more litigation coming out of this. Next, please. It allows a defendant to seek to vacate a conviction based upon violations. So while the law was originally written that you can only attack these proceedings for convictions that occur after the beginning of this year, the way it actually turns out, it appears, and we'll have to wait for the court to tell us which way this is or not, that a conviction that's occurred in the past where later we find out that there's some sort of racial bias or even racial language used or discriminatory language by any one of the parties might be the basis to vacate a conviction. So it does limit sort of the finality. And I'm used to 33 years as a prosecutor, when you talk to a victim of crime and say, thank you for being dragged through the criminal justice system, you're finished now. We can never say that anymore, because we're seeing more and more that finality of judgment is something that does not exist any longer. Next slide, please. Another large change was the creation of a misdemeanor diversion program. We in Riverside County have had a misdemeanor diversion program initiated by the district attorney's office, where we would offer defendants the ability to avoid a criminal conviction by virtue of going through a program. But this makes this diversion program and places the discretion in the court. And what it does is it creates a pre-plea diversion, which means that a case can be delayed for up to 2 years while a defendant tries to complete this program. If the defendant falls out of the program, then the case would resume again. So now you have a misdemeanor case that is over 2 years old that could be back in our criminal justice system. This is going to leave a large number of cases somewhat in limbo in our criminal justice system. And so we're probably going to see a greater burden on our judiciary as they try to juggle all of these cases. And not only will they have to have the cases come through the system, but they will also have monitoring of these cases. So our criminal justice courts that are already crowded will become more crowded. It does exempt certain domestic violence charges. It exempts domestic violence where you cause an injury, domestic violence where there is no visible physical injury, and it exempts stalking. But it does not exempt, next please. It does not exempt domestic violence charges such as restraining order violations or someone who is repeatedly violating restraining order. Those individuals can receive diversion. And next, please. And finally, the largest question about this bill, and the governor actually mentioned this in his signing of the bill, is whether DUI offenses, driving under the influence offenses, are exempt. The way the statute is currently written, it appears in the language of the statute that a court can grant diversion to a driving under the influence offense. although there's a vehicle code section which seems to suggest otherwise, and we've got some litigation that will be going on with that. Meanwhile, I can tell you the legislature just introduced a new bill which would address this gap in the law. So hopefully that will get addressed quickly and we will see an end to this confusion there. Sentencing changes. So criminal justice sentencing over the last number of years has pushed the sentencing of state prison inmates and taken the custody of them sort of out of the hands of CDCR on a large number of cases and pushed them to a local level, meaning our sheriff has the responsibility to house those. So that is one thing. AB 1950 is another change that occurred this year, and that reduces the length of time that an individual is on probation for those individuals that aren't sent to state prison. The length of time in which they have to make restitution or complete a program or to be supervised by our probation department, that length of time is reduced. Next, please. It used to be that you had 3 years on a felony and 2 years now you will have on a felony and only 1 year on a misdemeanor. So take someone who's driving under the influence, for example, who has to complete an AA program and a 16-week first-time offender program. They only have a year to complete that program now. And their some of the restrictions and terms that a court can place on them has also been limited. There are some exemptions for those statutes which list specific lengths of probation. But in general, this not only applies to people who will be placed on probation, but it applies to those individuals who are already on probation. And we are now seeing a large influx of court activity from impacting both the public defender's office and the district attorney's office of individuals who are seeking to have the length of their probation time reduced. Next, please. Again, SB 118 changes where an offender might serve their sentence. And it used to be that if you had certain enhancements or punishment, even if you committed what was an otherwise nonviolent offense, if you had such as armed with a firearm, you could be sent to state prison for that offense. So stealing a vehicle while armed with a firearm would be an example of that. This changes that, and those offenders will now be housed locally. So again, we are increasing the burdens on our local systems to deal with some of these offenders. And there are a lot of vagaries in that change. AB 2147 allows those who have served on fire crews to seek post-conviction relief. That means they can seek to have their sentence reduced. They can seek to have their sentence expunged because they served on a fire crew. And this is in recognition of those individuals who helped protect our communities during the fires, which ravaged our communities over the past few years. Next, please. Parole, this is kind of an interesting shift. This was another change that occurred. Next bullet point. Elderly parole was reduced from 60 years to 50 years, and I've kind of joked that I now qualify for elderly parole, which is kind of terrifying to me in some ways. It also reduced the length of time it would take someone who was incarcerated in CDCR to qualify for elderly parole. Next bullet point. The minimum length of time is now reduced to 20 years. So an individual who had been sentenced to a lengthy state prison sentence who reaches the age of 50 and has served 20 of those years in state prison is now eligible for parole, and they will come before a parole board to determine their suitability for release. That's releasing more individuals back into our local community. Next, please. Again, it doesn't apply to certain sentences, such as those defendants who receive life without the possibility of parole or first-degree murder on a peace officer. It does apply, however, to individuals convicted, say, of second-degree murder. It would apply to individuals convicted of first-degree murder on a non-police officer. So we will see this impact as this unrolls. Next, please. That's adult offenders. Our juvenile justice program is changing as well. DJJ, which is, if you want to look at it, it's that used to be called the California Youth Authority. This would essentially be the most severe housing that we have, or the most secure housing we have for juvenile offenders. It was a state-run program, and it is coming to an end. Next, please. Beginning in July, they will no longer accept new minor offenders. And this is a part of the governor's plan, which he's been very open about, to push this type of housing back down onto the local communities. So our probation department, which is tasked with housing juvenile offenders here in Riverside County, they will bear the burden of housing new offenders starting in July of this year. So we'll see an impact there as well. Officer-involved fatal shooting. As Jeff Van Wagenen mentioned, we have a force investigation detail here in Riverside County. That force investigation detail looks at the use of force by our law enforcement officers where they discharge their firearms. It involves fatal and non-fatal, but it will only involve fatal shootings where the subject was armed. Starting this year, you will see that the Attorney General's office will now start to take over the investigation of officer-involved fatal shootings where the suspect is unarmed. Next, please. The interesting thing here is it's the way the law was written. It's kind of vague as what does it mean to be unarmed? For example, if a suspect is driving a motor vehicle towards a law enforcement officer, is that suspect armed or unarmed? And there is some vagary in the legislation, and we look forward to seeing how that's going to play out. Our force investigation detail program, I think, is really a model for the way these cases are investigated across the state. We make sure that the agencies that are investigating these cases are not related to the officer or the officer's agency that is involved. And it gives the public, I think, a greater sense of confidence in the type of investigation, the manner the investigation is being done. So this is a new program. The Attorney General's office is prepared. There's actually three separate details of the Attorney General's office. There's one here in the Southern California area that will handle these types of incidents here in our region. And we have not had one yet, fortunately. So we have not dealt with this, and we look forward to seeing how this is going to play out. Next, please. Sex offender registration. This is actually a law that was passed in 2019, but it did not take effect until this year. And what it does is it takes sex offender registration, and those sex offenders used to have to register for life, regardless of the crime they committed. And now it changes that to a three-tiered system of 10, 20, or life. So there's a minimum for a misdemeanor, nonviolent, non-serious type of sex offense. That could be something like an indecent exposure, if you will. And that reduces that type of sex registration to a 10-year limit. Next, please. Most serious sex offenses will have a minimum of 20 years of registration. And next, please. And finally, our most serious sex offender violations will have lifetime registration. Those are sexually violent predators, habitual sex offenders, any type of very sex offense where you have penetration pretty much will qualify for this type of lifetime registration. Next, please. Those who are currently registered as sex offenders can petition beginning in July of this year to have their registration terminated. And this is going to have an impact on our law enforcement agencies because sex offenders are required to register with the agency where they reside. And if they are homeless, they are required to make periodic registrations where they are currently homeless. So we will see this impact our agencies because what we anticipate with this and what we've seen with laws similar to this is not only will those sex offenders who qualify to have their registration terminated petition, but we'll also see a large number of people who don't qualify try to file to see if they can sort of slip through. And that's been historic with what we've seen with similar types of changes in the law. And the initial filing goes to the local law enforcement agency. So we're going to see our local law enforcement agencies get hit with this. Our office has already met with many of the law enforcement agencies in the Coachella Valley. I think we may have actually hit them all and talked about the registration process and how that will work. Once the initial petitions are filed, the district attorney's office will become involved with the courts. Again, the public defender's office will take part in this as representative of the offender. And so again, we're going to see another burden on our criminal justice system, which has been backed up, as many of you are aware, for most of the past year with COVID shutting down a lot of the court process. We anticipate the courts will open back up for jury trials sometime in March. That's currently sort of the projection right now. We have been doing arraignments. We have been doing preliminary hearings, but by and large, our system is slowed down. And so there are a large number of cases sitting there waiting to be handled. And this will increase the burden on not just the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, but our courts and law enforcement agencies as well, because we'll need those agencies to come to court to testify. Next, please. Government Code 7286.5. Came about, and go ahead, next, please. It prohibits law enforcement from authorizing the use of the carotid restraint, which they commonly call the chokehold. As an aside, it's really not a chokehold. A chokehold is when you block the airway of a suspect. The carotid restraint hold simply cuts off the flow of blood to and from the brain. It's actually far more devastating than just cutting off someone's airflow. If you cut off someone's airflow, they can probably go for a little bit of time without that airflow. You cut off their blood flow to and from the brain, they'll lose consciousness in about 5 to 8 seconds, somewhere around that period of time. It's a very effective hold. We have seen in mixed martial arts, you've seen it in law enforcement, and we see it in the criminal justice system when offenders use it on their victims. It leaves behind no visible external injuries most of the time, although the internal injuries often can't be discerned without some sort of medical screening. Next, please. It talks about pressure being applied to the sides of a neck that restricts blood flow and may render a person unconscious. Next, please. This can create irreversible brain damage, and it certainly can. The one concern about this, I can tell you as someone who trains across the country on strangulation and the dangers of strangulation, while this is something that I think is positive to see in that it recognizes the dangers of strangulation, it does take away from law enforcement a tool that they have had. And one concern that we have heard from really both proponents and opponents of this piece of legislation is that if you take away this tool and law enforcement is left with fewer tools to use, will this increase the use of other forms of deadly force? And it's really kind of too soon to tell that. The other concern is, will a law enforcement officer that's faced with a situation where they might have otherwise applied this hold, will they be slow or hesitant to act and then fall victim themselves for failure to act? So we know that that's a big issue. Funding to DV shelters. This has a great impact here in the Coachella Valley. Next, please. DV shelters, in order to receive funding, used to have to provide matching funds or in-kind contributions. As many of you know, fundraising activities here in the Coachella Valley, which used to be quite rampant, have seen a huge drop off since we can't have these fundraising events. We can't have the types of social gatherings that we've had in the past. And so this eliminates the requirement that a shelter provide matching in-kind contributions and take some of the burden off the shelters to receive special funding. Next, please. Again, it recognizes the challenge in fundings, and I think it really does help us provide services for our victims of domestic violence out here in the region. Next, please. Lease termination. This is a bill that benefits victims of crime, and not just direct victims of crime, but those families that are impacted as well. It allows for early lease termination where the victim or an immediate family member has a specified crime, even if they did not live with the tenant and even if the crime occurred in another location. Oftentimes, victims need to relocate after crimes, and this helps them terminate their lease. This includes domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, human trafficking, elder abuse victims, or any crime where bodily injury or death is caused, where a firearm is used, or where threats of force are used against the victim of that crime. So it does provide a way out of leases. It doesn't just let them walk away. I need to be specific about that. There are some very specialized forms that must be used to extricate themselves from the lease, but it gives them the opportunity to move more freely. And we know that sometimes this is something that we have to do with our victims of crime. So next, please. Jury selection. So this was probably one of the most interesting bills. The Chief Justice has created a committee to look at the use of peremptory challenges. And a peremptory challenge is not a juror who can't be fair, but a juror who one side or the other simply thinks can't be fair or wouldn't be a good juror for the case. It used to be that if there was a challenge that someone was kicking somebody off a juror for a racial reason or a biased reason, that there was a two-step process involved, and the court has removed that now. Next, please. This will no longer be a two-step process. It will now be important for the side that is being challenged to tell the court exactly why, in a non-racial, non-biased reason, they are excluding the juror. Next, please. What it does, which is rather dramatic, is it removed a number of reasons for excusing a juror because it made those presumptively biased. So for example, a juror not paying attention during the jury selection process or looking disinterested might be a reason that you might want to exclude a juror. A juror who's had a negative experience with law enforcement might be a reason that you'd want to exclude a juror. Some of those reasons are now going to be presumptively biased, so you won't be able to do that. One of the challenges, and we just had a meeting with our Desert Bar Association, and one of the bench officers, one of the judges, was mentioning how this was going to make the jury selection process take much longer. And it might even make it more invasive to jurors, because now there might be a situation where we are going to have to identify jurors by race and by ethnicity. And that may not be readily apparent. They may have a last name or a surname, such as a name like Feynman. Well, is juror Feynman Jewish, or is juror Feynman not Jewish? You don't know. So we may have to make those inquiries. That legislation does not take place until January of next year, and we're hoping for some clarity before it does. So I've tried to race through that. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer them for anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Feynman. In the interest of time, what I'd like to do is ask staff to grab these slideshows and get them out to all of our members and your contact information. And so if we have some questions, we could get them to you and maybe get them out to all of our members, because that was a lot of information to get right now. Certainly, good information, but we'll get the slideshow from yourself and from Jeff and get them out to everyone. So I do have questions myself, but we need to move along. I know some folks have some other meetings to attend, but thank you for a presentation. Great presentation. The next item is all information. It's an attendance record and CV200, which is a coordinated approach to addressing the unsheltered homelessness issues. And that's kind of like CV100. It's just expanding on that. So that would be expanded during the homelessness committee meeting. And item number 10 is public comments on non-agenda items. So if you have any public comments, please raise your hand or hit *9 so your hand can be raised on the phone and we'll get to you. Do we see anyone, Erica?
Not see any.
Not see any. Okay, the next item is announcements, and our next Public Safety Committee meeting will be Monday, May 10th, 2021 at 9 p.m. Executive Committee will meet Monday, February 22nd, 2021 at 4:30 p.m. And I'd like to take this time to conclude our meeting in memorial of some of our fallen in our Public Safety Committee who are no longer with us. And my apologies if I miss anyone. I'd like to recognize Riverside County Sheriff's Department 15-year veteran Deputy Terrell Young, Riverside County Sheriff's Department 22-year veteran Deputy David Worksman, Riverside County Probation Department 7-year veteran Officer Julio Beltran, California Department of Corrections Indio resident Calipatria State Prison Jose Delgado, and Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick. They're now 10-7 in the watch, but their legacy will live forever. And that will conclude our meeting. And I'd like everyone to have a great day and the rest of your week. Thank you.